but a little like vomit. A biological smell, in other words, but a biological death, not a biological life. As my awareness sharpened more and more, I edged ever closer to panic. Whoever or whatever I was, I did not belong here. I needed to get out. But where would I go? Even as I asked that question, something new emerged from the darkness above. Something that wasn't cold or dead or dark, but the exact opposite of all those things. If I tried for the rest of my life, I would never be able to do justice to this entity that now approached me, to come anywhere close to describing how beautiful it was. But I'm going to try. Chapter 6, An Anchor to Life. Phyllis pulled into the hospital parking lot just under 2 hours after Eben the Fourth had, at around 1 a.m. When she got to my ICU room, she found Eben the Fourth sitting next to my bed, clutching a hospital pillow in front of him to help him keep awake. "Mom's home with Bond," Eben said, in a tone that was tired, tense, and happy to see her all at once. Phyllis told Eben he needed to go home, that if he stayed up all night after driving from Delaware, he'd be worthless to anyone tomorrow, his dad included. She called Holly and Jean at our house and told them Eben the Fourth would be back soon, but that she was staying in my room for the night. "Go home to your mom and your aunt and your brother," she said to Eben the Fourth when she'd hung up. "They need you. Your dad and I will be right here when you get back tomorrow." Eben the Fourth looked over at my body, at the clear plastic breathing tube running through my right nostril down to my trachea, at my thin, already chapping lips, at my closed eyes and sagging facial muscles. Phyllis read his thoughts. "Go home, Eben. Try not to worry. Your dad's still with us, and I'm not going to let him go." She walked to my bedside, picked up my hand, and started to massage it. With only the machines and the night nurse who came in to check my stats every hour for company, Phyllis sat through the rest of the night, holding my hand, keeping a connection going that she knew full well was vital if I was going to get through this. It's a cliche to talk about what a big emphasis people in the South put on family, but like a lot of cliches, it's also true. When I went to Harvard in 1988, one of the first things I noticed about Northerners was the way they were a little shyer about expressing a fact that many in the South take for granted. Your family is who you are. Throughout my own life, my relationship with my family, with my parents and sisters, and later with Holly, Eben the Fourth, and Bond, had always been a vital source of strength and stability, but even more so in recent years. Family was where I turned for unquestioning support in a world that, North or South, can all too often be short of this commodity. I went to our Episcopal church with Holly and the kids on occasion, but the fact was that for years I'd only been a step above a seeneer, that is, one who only darkens the door of a church at Christmas and Easter. I encouraged our boys to say their prayers at night, but I was no spiritual leader in our home. I'd never escaped my feelings of doubt at how any of it could really be. As much as I'd grown up wanting to believe in God and heaven and an afterlife, my decades in the rigorous scientific world of academic neurosurgery had profoundly called into question how such things could exist. Modern neuroscience dictates that the brain gives rise to consciousness, to the mind, to the soul, to the spirit, to whatever you choose to call that invisible, intangible part of us that truly makes us who we are. And I had little doubt that it was correct. Like most healthcare workers who deal directly with dying patients and their families, I had heard about, and even seen, some pretty inexplicable events over the years. I filed those occurrences under unknown, and let them be, figuring a common sense answer of one kind or another lay at the heart of them all. Not that I was opposed to supernatural beliefs. As a doctor who saw incredible physical and emotional suffering on a regular basis, the last thing I would have wanted to do was to deny anyone the comfort and hope that faith provided. In fact, I would have loved to have enjoyed some of it myself. The older I got, however, the less likely that seemed. Like an ocean wearing away a beach, over the years my scientific worldview gently but steadily undermined my ability to believe in something larger. Science seemed to be providing a steady onslaught of evidence that pushed our significance in the universe ever closer to zero. Belief would have been nice. But science is not concerned with what would be nice. It's concerned with what is. I'm a kinetic learner, which is just to say that I learn by doing. If I can't feel something or touch it myself, it's hard for me to take interest in it. That desire to reach out and touch whatever I'm trying to understand was, along with a desire to be like my father, what drew me to neurosurgery. As abstract and mysterious as the human brain is, it's also incredibly concrete. As a medical student at Duke, I relished looking into a microscope and actually seeing the delicately elongated neuronal cells that spark the synaptic connections that give rise to consciousness. I loved the combination of abstract knowledge and total physicality that brain surgery presented. To access the brain, one must pull away the layers of skin and tissue covering the skull and apply a high-speed pneumatic device called a Midas Rex drill. It's a very sophisticated piece of equipment costing thousands of dollars, yet when you get down to it, it's also just a drill. Likewise, surgically repairing the brain, while an extraordinarily complex undertaking, is actually no different than fixing any other highly delicate electrically charged machine. That, I knew full well, is what the brain really is, a machine that produces the phenomenon of consciousness. Sure, scientists hadn't discovered exactly how the neurons of the brain managed to do this, but it was only a matter of time before they would. This was proven every day in the operating room. A patient comes in with headaches and diminished consciousness. You obtain an MRI, magnetic resonance image, of her brain and discover a tumor. You place the patient under general anesthesia, remove the tumor, and a few hours later she's waking up to the world again. No more headaches, no more trouble with consciousness. Seemingly pretty simple. I adored that simplicity, the absolute honesty and cleanness of science. I respected that it left no room for fantasy or for sloppy thinking. If a fact could be established as tangible and trustworthy, it was accepted. If not, then it was rejected. This approach left very little room for the soul and the spirit, for the continuing existence of a personality after the brain that supported it stopped functioning. It left even less room for those words I'd heard in church again and again, life everlasting. Which is why I counted on my family, on Holly, and our boys, and my three sisters, and of course my mom and dad, so much. In a very real sense, I'd never have been able to practice my profession, to perform day in and day out the actions I performed, and to see the things I saw, without the bedrock support of love and understanding they provided. And that was why Phyllis, after consulting our sister Betsy on the phone, decided that night to make a promise to me on behalf of our whole family. As she sat there with my limp, nearly lifeless hand in hers, she told me that no matter what happened from then on, someone would always be right there holding my hand. "We are not letting you go, Eben," she said. "You need an anchor to keep you here, in this world, where we need you, and we'll provide it." Little did she know just how important that anchor was going to prove in the days to come. Chapter 7. The Spinning Melody in the Gateway. Something had appeared in the darkness. Turning slowly, it radiated fine filaments of white gold light. And as it did so, the darkness around me began to splinter and break apart. Then I heard a new sound, a living sound, like the richest, most complex, most beautiful piece of music you've ever heard. Growing in volume as a pure, white light descended, it obliterated the monotonous mechanical pounding that, seemingly for eons, had been my only company up until then. The light got closer and closer, spinning around and around and generating those filaments of pure white light that I now saw were tinged here and there with hints of gold. Then, at the very center of the light, something else appeared. I focused my awareness hard, trying to figure out what it was. An opening. I was no longer looking at the slowly spinning light at all, but through it. The moment I understood this, I began to move up, fast. There was a whooshing sound, and in a flash I went through the opening and found myself in a completely new world. The strangest, most beautiful world I'd ever seen. brilliant, vibrant, ecstatic, stunning. I could heap on one adjective after another to describe what this world looked and felt like, but they'd all fall short. I felt like I was being born. Not reborn or born again. Just born. Below me there was countryside. It was green, lush, and earth-like. It was earth, but at the same time it wasn't. It was like when your parents take you back to a place where you spent some years as a very young child. You don't know the place, or at least you think you don't. But as you look around, something pulls at you, and you realize that a part of yourself, a part way deep down, does remember the place after all, and is rejoicing at being back there again. I was flying, passing over trees and fields, streams and waterfalls, and here and there, people. There were children, too, laughing and playing. The people sang and danced around in circles, and sometimes I'd see a dog running and jumping among them, as full of joy as the people were. They wore simple yet beautiful clothes, and it seemed to me that the colors of these clothes had the same kind of living warmth as the trees and the flowers that bloomed and blossomed in the countryside around them. A beautiful, incredible dream world. Except it wasn't a dream. Though I didn't know where I was or even what I was absolutely sure of one thing. This place I'd suddenly found myself in was completely real. The word real expresses something abstract, and it's frustratingly ineffective at conveying what I'm trying to describe. Imagine being a kid and going to a movie on a summer day. Maybe the movie was good, and you were entertained as you sat through it. But then the show ended, and you filed out of the theater and back into the deep, vibrant, welcoming warmth of the summer afternoon. And as the air and the sunlight hit you, you wondered why on earth you'd wasted this gorgeous day sitting in a dark theater. Multiply that feeling 1,000 times over, and you still won't be anywhere close to what it felt like where I was. I don't know how long, exactly, I flew along. Time in this place was different from the simple, linear time we experience on Earth, and is as hopelessly difficult to describe as every other aspect of it. But at some point, I realized that I wasn't alone up there. Someone was next to me, a beautiful girl with high cheekbones and deep blue eyes. She was wearing the same kind of peasant-like clothes that the people in the village down below wore. Golden brown tresses framed her lovely face. We were riding along together on an intricately patterned surface, alive with indescribable and vivid colors, the wing of a butterfly. In fact, millions of butterflies were all around us, vast fluttering waves of them, dipping down into the greenery and coming back up around us again. It wasn't any single discrete butterfly that appeared, but all of them together, as if they were a river of life and color moving through the air. We flew in lazy, looped formations past blossoming flowers and buds on trees that opened as we flew near. The girl's outfit was simple, but its colors, powder blue, indigo, and pastel orange peach, had the same overwhelming, super vivid aliveness that everything else in the surroundings had. She looked at me with a look that, if you saw it for a few moments, would make your whole life up to that point worth living, no matter what had happened in it so far. It was not a romantic look. It was not a look of friendship. It was a look that was somehow beyond all these, beyond all the different types of love we have down here on Earth. It was something higher, holding all those other kinds of love within itself, while at the same time being more genuine and pure than all of them. Without using any words, she spoke to me. The message went through me like a wind, and I instantly understood that it was true. I knew so in the same way that I knew that the world around us was real, was not some fantasy passing and insubstantial. The message had three parts, and if I had to translate them into earthly language, I'd say they ran something like this. You are loved and cherished, dearly, forever. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. The message flooded me with a vast and crazy sensation of relief. It was like being handed the rules to a game I'd been playing all my life without ever fully understanding it. "We will show you many things here," the girl said, again, without actually using these words, but by driving their conceptual essence directly into me. "But eventually, you will go back." To this, I had only one question. Back where? Remember who's talking to you right now. I'm not a soft-headed sentimentalist. I know what death looks like. I know what it feels like to have a living person whom you spoke to and joked with in better days become a lifeless object on an operating table after you've struggled for hours to keep the machine of their body working. I know what suffering looks like and the answerless grief on the faces of loved ones who have lost someone they never dreamed they could lose. I know my biology, and while I'm not a physicist, I'm no slouch at that either. I know the difference between fantasy and reality, and I know that the experience I'm struggling to give you the vaguest, most completely unsatisfactory picture of was the single most real experience of my life. In fact, the only competition for it in the reality department was what came next. Chapter 8. Israel. By 8 the next morning, Holly was back in my room. She spelled Phyllis, taking her place in the chair by the head of my bed and squeezing my still unresponsive hand in hers. Around 11 a.m., Michael Sullivan arrived, and everyone formed a circle around me, with Betsy holding my hand so that I was included too. Michael led a prayer. They were just finishing when one of the doctors specializing in infectious diseases came in with a fresh report from downstairs. Despite their adjusting my antibiotics overnight, my white blood cell count was still rising. The bacteria were continuing, unimpeded, with the task of eating my brain. Fast running out of options, the doctors once more went over the details of my activities in the past few days with Holly. Then they stretched their questions to cover the past few weeks. Was there anything, anything, in the details of what I'd been doing that could help them make sense of my condition? "Well," said Holly, "he did take a work trip to Israel a few months ago." Dr. Brennan looked up from his notepad. "E. coli bacterial cells can swap DNA not only with other E. coli, but with other gram-negative bacterial organisms as well. This has enormous implications in our time of global travel, antibiotic bombardment, and fast-mutating new strains of bacterial illnesses. If some E. coli bacteria find themselves in a harsh biological environment with some other primitive organisms that are better suited than they are, the E. coli can potentially pick up some DNA from those better suited bacteria and incorporate it. In 1996, doctors discovered a new bacterial strain harboring DNA for a gene coding for Klebsiella pneumonia carbapenemase, or KPC, an enzyme that conferred antibiotic resistance on its host bacterium. It was found in the stomach of a patient who died in a North Carolina hospital. The strain immediately got the attention of doctors all over the world when it was discovered that KPC could potentially render a bacteria that absorbed it resistant not just to some current antibiotics, but to all of them. If a toxic, antibiotic-proof strain of bacteria, one whose non-toxic cousin is ubiquitous in our bodies, got loose in the general population, it would have a field day with the human race. There are no new antibiotics in the 10-year pharmaceutical development pipeline that could come to the rescue. Just a few months earlier, Dr. Brennan knew, a patient had checked into a hospital with a powerful bacterial infection and was given a range of powerful antibiotics in an effort to control his Klebsiella pneumonia infection. But the man's condition continued to worsen. Tests revealed that he was still suffering from Klebsiella pneumoniae and that the antibiotics hadn't done their work. Further tests revealed that the bacteria living in the man's large intestine had acquired the KPC gene by direct plasmid transfer from his resistant Klebsiella pneumoniae infection. In other words, his body had provided the laboratory for the creation of a species of bacteria that, if it got into the general population, might rival the Black Death, a plague that killed off half of Europe in the 14th century. The hospital where all this occurred was the Sieraski Medical Center in Tel Aviv, Israel, and it had occurred just a few months previously. As a matter of fact, it happened at about the time that I'd been there, as part of my work coordinating a global research initiative in focused ultrasound brain surgery. I'd arrived in Jerusalem at 3:15 a.m. and after finding my hotel, had decided on a whim to walk to the Old City. I ended up taking a lone pre-dawn tour of the Via Dolorosa and visiting the alleged site of the Last Supper. The trip had been strangely moving, and once back in the States, I'd often brought it up with Holly. But at the time, I'd known nothing of the patient at the Sieraski Medical Center or the bacteria he contracted that picked up the KPC gene. Bacteria that, it developed, was itself a strain of E. coli. Could I have somehow picked up an antibiotic-proof KPC-harboring bacteria while I was over in Israel? It was unlikely, but it was a possible explanation for the apparent resistance of my infection, and my doctors went to work to determine if that was indeed the bacteria that was attacking my brain. My case was about to become, for the first of many reasons, a part of medical history. Chapter 9. The Core. Meanwhile, I was in a place of clouds. Big, puffy, pink-white ones that showed up sharply against the deep blue-black sky. Higher than the clouds, immeasurably higher, flocks of transparent orbs, shimmering beings arced across the sky, leaving long, streamer-like lines behind them. Birds? Angels? These words registered when I was writing down my recollections. But neither of these words do justice to the beings themselves, which were quite simply different from anything I have known on this planet. They were more advanced, higher. A sound, huge and booming, like a glorious chant, came down from above, and I wondered if the winged beings were producing it. Again, thinking about it later, it occurred to me that the joy of these creatures as they soared along was such that they had to make this noise. That if the joy didn't come out of them this way, then they would simply not otherwise be able to contain it. The sound was palpable and almost material, like a rain that you can feel on your skin but that doesn't get you wet. Seeing and hearing were not separate in this place where I now was. I could hear the visual beauty of the silvery bodies of those scintillating beings above, and I could see the surging, joyful perfection of what they sang. It seemed that you could not look at or listen to anything in this world without becoming a part of it, without joining with it in some mysterious way. Again, from my present perspective, I would suggest that you couldn't look at anything in that world at all, for the word at itself implies a separation that did not exist there. Everything was distinct, yet everything was also a part of everything else, like the rich and intermingled designs on a Persian carpet or a butterfly's wing. A warm wind blew through, like the kind that spring up on the most perfect summer days, tossing the leaves of the trees and flowing past like heavenly water. A divine breeze. It changed everything, shifting the world around me into an even higher octave, a higher vibration. Although I still had very little language function, at least as we think of it on Earth, I began wordlessly putting questions to this wind and to the divine being that I sensed at work behind or within it. Where is this place? Who am I? Why am I here? Each time I silently posed one of these questions, the answer came instantly in an explosion of light, color, love, and beauty that blew through me like a crashing wave. What was important about these bursts was that they didn't simply silence my questions by overwhelming them. They answered them, but in a way that bypassed language. Thoughts entered me directly, but it wasn't thought like we experience on Earth. It wasn't vague, immaterial, or abstract. These thoughts were solid and immediate, hotter than fire and wetter than water, and as I received them, I was able to instantly and effortlessly understand concepts that would have taken me years to fully grasp in my earthly life. I continued moving forward and found myself entering an immense void, completely dark, infinite in size, yet also infinitely comforting. Pitch black as it was also brimming over with light, a light that seemed to come from a brilliant orb that I now sensed near me, an orb that was living and almost solid, as the songs of the angel beings had been. My situation was, strangely enough, something akin to that of a fetus in a womb. The fetus floats in the womb with a silent partner of the placenta, which nourishes it and mediates its relationship to the everywhere present yet at the same time invisible mother. In this case, the mother was God, the creator, the source, who was responsible for making the universe and all in it. This being was so close that there seemed to be no distance at all between God and myself. Yet at the same time, I could sense the infinite vastness of the Creator, could see how completely minuscule I was by comparison. I will occasionally use Om as the pronoun for God, because I originally used that name in my original writings after my coma. Om was the sound I remembered hearing associated with that omniscient, omnipotent, and unconditionally loving God, but any descriptive word falls short. The pure vastness separating Om and me was, I realized, why I had the orb as my companion. In some manner, I couldn't completely comprehend, but was sure of nonetheless. The orb was a kind of interpreter between me and this extraordinary presence surrounding me. It was as if I were being born into a larger world, and the universe itself was like a giant cosmic womb. And the orb, who remained in some way connected to the girl on the butterfly wing, who in fact was she, was guiding me through this process. Later, when I was back here in the world, I found a quotation by the 17th century Christian poet Henry Vaughan that came close to describing this place, this vast, inky black core that was the home of the divine itself. There is, some say, in God a deep but dazzling darkness. That was it exactly. An inky darkness that was also full to brimming with light. The questions and the answers continued. Though they still didn't come in the form of language as we know it, the voice of this being was warm and, odd as I know this may sound, personal. It understood humans, and it possessed the qualities we possess, only in infinitely greater measure. It knew me deeply and overflowed with qualities that all my life I've always associated with human beings, and human beings alone. Warmth, compassion, pathos, even irony and humor. Through the orb, Om told me that there is not one universe, but many. In fact, more than I could conceive. But that love lay at the center of them all. Evil was present in all the other universes as well, but only in the tiniest trace amounts. Evil was necessary because without it, free will was impossible. And without free will, there could be no growth, no forward movement, no chance for us to become what God longed for us to be. Horrible and all-powerful as evil sometimes seemed to be in a world like ours, in the larger picture, love was overwhelmingly dominant, and it would ultimately be triumphant. I saw the abundance of light throughout the countless universes, including some whose intelligence was advanced far beyond that of humanity. I saw that there are countless higher dimensions, but that the only way to know these dimensions is to enter and experience them directly. They cannot be known or understood from lower dimensional space. Cause and effect exist in these higher realms, but outside of our earthly conception of them. The world of time and space in which we move in this terrestrial realm is tightly and intricately meshed within these higher worlds. In other words, these worlds aren't totally apart from us because all worlds are part of the same overarching divine reality. From those higher worlds, one could access any time or place in our world. It will take me the rest of my life and then some to unpack what I learned up there. The knowledge given me was not taught in the way that a history lesson or math theorem would be. Insights happen directly, rather than needing to be coaxed and absorbed. Knowledge was stored without memorization, instantly and for good, It didn't fade like ordinary information does, and to this day I still possess all of it, much more clearly than I possess the information that I gained over all my years in school. That's not to say that I can get to this knowledge just like that. Because now that I'm back here in the earthly realm, I have to process it through my limited physical body and brain. But it's there. I feel it, laid into my very being. For a person like me who had spent his whole life working hard to accumulate knowledge and understanding the old-fashioned way, the discovery of this more advanced level of learning was, alone, enough to give me food for thought for ages to come. Unfortunately, for my family and my doctors back on Earth, the situation was very different. Chapter 10. What Counts? Holly didn't fail to notice how interested the doctors became when she mentioned my trip to Israel. But of course, she didn't understand why it was so important. In retrospect, it was a blessing that she didn't. Coping with my possible death was burden enough, without the added possibility that I was the index case for the 21st century equivalent of the Black Plague. Meanwhile, more calls went out to friends and family, including to my biological family. As a young boy, I'd worshiped my father, who was chief of staff for 20 years at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center in Winston-Salem. I chose academic neurosurgery as a career in order to follow in his footsteps as closely as I could, despite knowing I'd never completely fill his shoes. My father was a deeply spiritual man. He served as a surgeon in the Army Air Force in the jungles of New Guinea and the Philippines during World War II. He witnessed brutality and suffered himself. He told me about nights spent operating on battle casualties in tents that barely held up under the blankets of monsoon rain hitting them, the heat and humidity so oppressive that the surgeons stripped down to their underwear just to be able to endure it. Dad had married the love of his life and his commanding officer's daughter, Betty, in October 1942, while training for his stint in the Pacific Theater. At war's end, he was part of the initial group of Allied forces occupying Japan after the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. As the only U.S. military neurosurgeon in Tokyo, he was officially indispensable. He was qualified to perform ear, nose, and throat surgery to boot. All of these qualifications ensured that he would not be going anywhere for quite some time. His new commanding officer would not allow him to go back to the States until the situation was more stable. Several months after the Japanese formally surrendered aboard the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay, Dad at last received general orders releasing him to go home. However, he knew that the on-site CO would have these orders rescinded if he saw them. So Dad waited until the weekend, when that CO was off base for R&R, and processed the orders through the stand-in CO. He was finally able to board a ship bound for home in December 1945, long after most of his fellow soldiers had returned to their families. After coming back to the States in early 1946, Dad went on to finish his neurosurgical training with his friend and Harvard Medical School classmate, Donald Mattson, who had served in the European theater. They trained at the Peter Bent Brigham and the Children's Hospitals in Boston, flagship hospitals of Harvard Medical School, under Dr. Frank D. Ingram, who had been one of the last residents trained by Dr. Harvey Cushing, globally regarded as the father of modern neurosurgery. In the 1950s and 1960s, the entire cadre of 3131C neurosurgeons, as they were officially classified by the Army Air Force, who had honed their craft on the battlefields of Europe and the Pacific, went on to set the bar for the next half century of neurosurgeons, including those in my own generation. My parents grew up during the Depression and were hardwired for work. Dad just about always made it home for family dinner at 7 p.m., usually in a suit and tie, but occasionally wearing surgical scrubs. Then he'd return to the hospital, often taking one of us kids along to do our homework in his office while he made rounds on his patients. For Dad, life and work were essentially synonymous, and he raised us accordingly. He usually made my sisters and me do yard work on Sundays. If we told him we wanted to go to the movies, he'd reply, If you go to the movies, then someone else has to work. He was also fiercely competitive. On the squash court, he considered every game a battle to the death, and even into his 80s was always in search of fresh opponents, often decades younger. He was a demanding parent, but also a wonderful one. He treated everyone he met with respect and carried a screwdriver in the pocket of his lab coat to tighten any loose screws he might encounter during his rounds of the hospital. His patients, his fellow physicians, the nurses, and the entire hospital staff loved him. Whether it was operating on patients, helping to advance research, training neurosurgeons, a singular passion, or editing the journal Surgical Neurology, which he did for a number of years, Dad saw his path in life clearly marked out for him. Even after he finally aged out of the operating room at 71, he continued to keep up with the latest developments in the field. After his death in 2004, his longtime partner, Dr. David L. Kelly, Jr., wrote, "Dr. Alexander will always be remembered for his enthusiasm and proficiencies, his perseverance and attention to detail, his spirit of compassion, honesty, and excellence in all that he did." No great surprise that I, like so many others, worshipped him. Very early on, so far back I don't even remember when it was, Mom and Dad had told me that I was adopted, or chosen, as they put it, because they assured me they'd known I was their child from the moment they saw me. They were not my biological birth parents, but they loved me dearly, as if I were their own flesh and blood. I grew up knowing that I'd been adopted in April 1954 at the age of 4 months, and that my biological mother had been 16 years old, a sophomore in high school, unwed when she gave birth to me in 1953. Her boyfriend, a senior with no immediate prospects for being able to support a child, had agreed to give me up as well, though neither had wanted to. The knowledge of all this came so early that it was simply a part of who I was, as accepted and unquestioned as the jet black color of my hair and the fact that I liked hamburgers and disliked cauliflower. I loved my adoptive parents just as much as I would have if they had been true blood relations, and they clearly felt the same about me. My older sister, Jean, had also been adopted, but 5 months after they adopted me, my mother was able to conceive herself. She delivered a baby girl, my sister Betsy, and 5 years later, Phyllis, our youngest sister, was born. We were full siblings for all intents and purposes. I knew that wherever I had come from, I was their brother and they were my sisters. I grew up in a family that not only loved me, but also believed in me and supported my dreams, including the dream that seized me in high school and never let go till I achieved it, to be a neurosurgeon like my father. I didn't think about my adoption during my college and medical school years, at least not on the surface. I did reach out to the Children's Home Society of North Carolina several times, inquiring whether or not my mother had any interest in reuniting. But North Carolina had some of the nation's strictest laws to protect the anonymity of adoptees and their birth parents, even if they desperately wanted to reconnect. After my late 20s, I thought about the matter less and less. And once I met Holly and we started our own family, the question drifted ever further away, or ever deeper inside. In 1999, when he was 12 and we were still living in Massachusetts, Eben IV got involved in a family heritage project at the Charles River School, where he was a sixth grader. He knew I'd been adopted, and thus that he had direct relatives on the planet whom he didn't know personally or even by name. The project sparked something in him, a deep curiosity that he hadn't, up to that point, known he had. He asked me if we could seek out my birth parents. I told him that over the years I'd occasionally looked into the matter myself, contacting the Children's Home Society of North Carolina and asking if they had any news. If my biological mom or dad desired contact, the society would know. But I had never heard anything back. Not that it bothered me. "It's perfectly natural in a circumstance like this," I told Eben. "It doesn't mean my birth mom doesn't love me, or that she wouldn't love you if she ever set eyes on you. But she doesn't want to, most likely because she feels like you and I have our own family, and she doesn't want to get in the way of that." Evan wouldn't let it go, though, so finally I thought I'd humor him and wrote a social worker named Betty at the children's home who'd helped me with my request before. A few weeks later, on a snowy Friday afternoon in February 2000, Evan IV and I were driving from Boston up to Maine for a weekend of skiing when I remembered I was due to give Betty a call to check on her progress. I called her on my cell phone and she answered. "Well, in fact," she said, "I do have some news. Are you sitting down?" I was in fact sitting down, so I said as much, admitting that I was also driving my car through a blizzard. "It turns out, Dr. Alexander, that your birth parents actually got married." My heart hammered in my chest, and the road in front of me suddenly turned unreal and far away. Though I'd known that my parents were sweethearts, I'd always assumed that once they'd given me up, their lives had taken separate directions. Instantly, a picture appeared in my head. A picture of my birth parents and of a home that they'd made somewhere, a home I had never known, a home where I didn't belong. Betty interrupted my thoughts. "Dr. Alexander?" "Yes," I said slowly. "I'm here." "There's more." To Evan's puzzlement, I pulled the car over to the side of the road and told her to go ahead. "Your parents had three more children, two sisters and a brother. I've been in touch with the older sister, and she told me your younger sister died 2 years ago. Your parents are still grieving their loss." "So that means," I asked, after a long pause, still numb, taking it all in without really being able to process any of it. "I'm sorry, Dr. Alexander, but yes, it means she is refusing your request for contact." Evan shifted in the seat behind me, clearly aware that something of importance had just happened, but stumped as to what it was. "What is it, Dad?" he asked after I'd hung up. "Nothing," I said. "The agency still doesn't know much, but they're working on it. Maybe sometime. Maybe." But my voice trailed off. Outside, the storm was really picking up. I could only see about 100 yards into the low white woods spreading out all around us. I put the car in gear, squinted carefully into the rearview mirror, and pulled back onto the road. In an instant, my view of myself had been totally changed. After that phone call, I was, of course, still everything I'd been before. Still a scientist, still a doctor, still a father, still a husband. But I also felt, for the first time ever, like an orphan. Someone who had been given away. Someone less than fully 100% wanted. I had never, before that phone call, really thought of myself that way, as someone cut off from my source. I'd never defined myself in the context of something I had lost and could never regain, but suddenly it was the only thing about myself I could see. Over the next few months, an ocean of sadness opened up within me, a sadness that threatened to swamp and sink everything in my life I'd worked so hard to create up to that point. This was only made worse by my inability to get to the bottom of what was causing the situation. I'd run into problems in myself before, shortcomings as I'd seen them, and I'd corrected them. In med school and in my early days as a surgeon, for example, I'd been part of a culture where heavy drinking, under the right circumstances, was smiled upon. But in 1991, I began to notice that I was looking forward to my day off and the drinks that went along with it just a little too eagerly. I decided that it was time for me to stop drinking alcohol altogether. This was not easy by any stretch. I'd come to rely on the release provided by those off hours more than I'd known, and I only made it through those early days of sobriety with my family's support. So here was another problem, clearly with only me to blame for it. I had help to deal with it if I chose to ask. Why couldn't I nip it in the bud? It just didn't seem right that a piece of knowledge about my past, a piece I had no control over whatsoever, should be able to so completely derail me both emotionally and professionally. So I struggled, and I watched in disbelief as my roles as doctor, father, and husband became ever more difficult to fulfill. Seeing that I was not my best self, Holly set us up for a course of couples counseling. Though she only partially understood what was causing it, she forgave me for falling into this ditch of despair and did whatever she could to pull me up out of it. My depression had ramifications in my work. My parents were, of course, aware of this change, and though I knew they too forgave it, it killed me that my career in academic neurosurgery was slumping, and all they could do was watch from the sidelines. Without my participation, my family was powerless to help me. And finally, I watched as this new sadness exposed, then swept away, something else. My last half-acknowledged hope that there was some personal element in the universe, some force beyond the scientific ones I'd spent years studying. In less clinical terms, it swept away my last belief that there might be a being of some kind out there who truly loved and cared about me, and that my prayers might be heard and even answered. After that phone call during the blizzard, the notion of a loving, personal God, my birthright to some degree, as a church-going member of a culture that took that God with genuine seriousness, vanished completely. Was there a force or intelligence watching out for all of us, who cared about humans in a truly loving way? It was a surprise to have to finally admit that in spite of all my medical training and experience, I was clearly still keenly, if secretly, interested in this question. Just as I'd been much more interested in the question of my birth parents than I'd ever realized. Unfortunately, the answer to the question of whether there was such a being was the same as the answer to the question of whether my birth parents would once again open their lives and their hearts to me. That answer was no. Chapter 11, An End to the Downward Spiral. For much of the next 7 years, my career and my family life continued to suffer. For a long time, the people around me, even those closest to me, weren't sure what was causing the problem. But gradually, through remarks I'd make almost in passing, Holly and my sisters put the pieces together. Finally, on an early morning walk on a South Carolina beach during a family vacation in July 2007, Betsy and Phyllis brought up the topic. "Have you thought about writing another letter to your birth family?" Phyllis asked. "Yes," Betsy said. "Things might have changed by now. You never know." Betsy had recently told us she was thinking of adopting a child herself, so I wasn't totally surprised that the topic had come up. But all the same, my immediate response, mental rather than verbal, was, "Oh, no, not again." I remembered the immense chasm that had cracked open beneath me after the rejection I'd faced 7 years earlier. But I knew Betsy and Phyllis's hearts were in the right place. They knew I was suffering, they'd finally figured out why, and they wanted, rightly, for me to step up and try to fix the problem. They assured me that they would travel this road with me, that I wouldn't be taking this journey alone, as I had done before. We were a team. So in early August 2007, I wrote an anonymous letter to my birth sister, the keeper of the gate on the matter, and sent it to Betty at the Children's Home Society of North Carolina to forward along. "Dear sister, I'm interested in communicating with you, our brother, and our parents. After a long talk with my adoptive family, sisters, and mother about this, their support and interest rekindled my wanting to know more about my biological family. My two sons, ages 9 and 19, are interested in their heritage. The three of us and my wife would be grateful to you for any background information that you feel comfortable sharing. For me, questions come to mind about my birth parents regarding their lives and their younger years until now. What interests and personalities do you all have? In that we are all growing older, my hopes are to meet them soon. Our arrangements can be in mutual agreement. Please know that I feel most respectful of the degree of privacy that they wish to maintain. I've had a wonderful adoptive family and appreciate my biological parents' decision in their youth. My interest is genuine and receptive to any boundaries they feel are necessary. Your consideration in this matter is deeply appreciated. Most sincerely yours, your older brother. A few weeks later, I received a letter from the Children's Home Society. It was from my birth sister. "Yes, we would love to meet you," she wrote. North Carolina state law forbade her from revealing any identifying information to me, but working around those parameters, she gave me my first real set of clues about the biological family I had never met. When she reported that my birth father had been a naval aviator in Vietnam, it just blew me away. No wonder I had always loved to jump out of airplanes and fly sailplanes. My birth dad was also, I was further stunned to learn, an astronaut trainee with NASA during the Apollo missions in the mid-1960s. I myself had considered training as a mission specialist on the space shuttle in 1983. My birth dad later worked as an airline pilot for Pan Am and Delta. In October 2007, I finally met my biological parents, Anne and Richard, and my biological siblings, Kathy and David. Anne told me the full story of how, in 1953, she spent 3 months at the Florence Crittenden Home for Unwed Mothers, located next to Charlotte Memorial Hospital. All of the girls there had code names, and because she loved American history, my mother chose Virginia Dare, the name of the first baby born to English settlers in the New World. Most of the girls just called her Dare. At 16, she was the youngest girl there. She told me that her daddy had been willing to do anything to help her when he learned of her predicament. He was willing to pick up and move the whole family if necessary. He had been unemployed for a while, and bringing a new baby into the home would be a great financial stress, not to mention all the other problems. A close friend of his had even mentioned a doctor he knew of down in Dillon, South Carolina, who could fix things. But her mother wouldn't hear of that. Anne told me how she had looked up at the stars twinkling wildly in the gusty winds of a newly arrived cold front on that frigid December night in 1953, how she had walked across the empty streets under scattered low racing clouds. She had wanted this time to be alone, with just the moon and stars and her soon-to-be-born child, me. The crescent moon hung low in the west. Brilliant Jupiter was just rising to watch over us all night. Richard loved science and astronomy, and he later told me that Jupiter was at opposition that night and would not be as bright again for almost 9 years. Over that time, much would happen in our lives, including the births of 2 more children. But at the time, I just thought how beautiful and bright the King of Planets appeared, watching over us from above. As she entered the hospital foyer, a magical thought struck her. Girls generally stayed in the Crittenden home for 2 weeks after they delivered their babies. Then they'd go home and pick up their lives where they'd left off. If she really delivered that night, she and I might be home for Christmas, if they actually set her free at 2 weeks. What a perfect miracle that would be, to bring me home by Christmas Day. Dr. Crawford was fresh from another delivery, and he looked awfully tired, Anne told me. He laid an ether-soaked gauze over her face to ease the pain, so she was only semi-conscious when finally, at 2:42 a.m., with one last great push, she gave birth to her first child. Anne told me that she wanted so much to hold and caress me, that she would never forget hearing my cries until fatigue and that anesthetic finally won out. Over the next 4 hours, first Mars, then Saturn, then Mercury, and finally brilliant Venus, rose in the eastern sky to greet me into this world. Meanwhile, Anne slept more deeply than she had in months. The nurse awakened her before sunrise. "I have someone I want you to meet," she said cheerfully, and presented me, swaddled in a sky-blue blanket, for her to admire. "The nurses all agreed that you were the most beautiful baby in the whole nursery. I was bursting with pride." As much as Anne wanted to keep me, the cold reality that she couldn't soon sank in. Richard had dreams of going to college, but those dreams would not keep me fed. Perhaps I felt Anne's pain because I stopped eating. At 11 days, I was hospitalized with the diagnosis that I was failing to thrive. And my first Christmas and the following 9 days were spent in the hospital in Charlotte. After I was admitted to the hospital, Anne took the 2-hour bus ride north to her small hometown. She spent that Christmas with her parents, sisters, and friends, whom she had not seen in 3 months, all without me. By the time I was eating again, my separate life was underway. Anne sensed that she was losing control and that they weren't going to allow her to keep me. When she called the hospital just after New Year's, she was told that I had been sent to the Children's Home Society in Greensboro. "Sent with a volunteer? How unfair," she said. I spent the next 3 months living in a baby dorm with several other infants whose mothers could not keep them. My crib was on the second floor of a bluish-gray Victorian home that had been donated to the society. "It was a most pleasant place for your first home," Anne told me with a laugh, even though it was mainly a baby dorm. Anne took the 3-hour bus ride to visit half a dozen times over the next few months, trying desperately to come up with a plan that would succeed in keeping me with her. Once she came with her mother, and another time with Richard. Although the nurses made him view me through the window, they would not let him in the same room and certainly not let him hold me. But by late March 1954, it was clear that things weren't going to go her way. She would have to give me up. She and her mother took the bus to Greensboro one last time. "I had to hold you and look in your eyes and try to explain it all to you," Anne told me. "I knew you would just giggle and coo, blow baby bubbles, and make pleasing sounds no matter what I said, but I felt I owed you an explanation. I held you closely one last time, kissed your ears, chest, and face, and caressed you gently. I remember inhaling deeply, loving that wonderful aroma of freshly bathed baby, as if it were yesterday. I called you by your birth name and said, 'I love you so much you'll never know, and I'll love you forever until the day I die.' I said, 'God, please let him know how much he is loved, that I love him and always will,' but I had no way of knowing if my prayer would be answered. Adoption arrangements in the 1950s were final and very secret. No turning back, no explanations. Sometimes birth dates were changed in the records just to hamper anyone's efforts to uncover the truth about a baby's origins, leave nothing to trace. Agreements were protected by harsh state laws. The rule was to forget it ever happened and go on with the rest of your life, and hopefully learn from it. I kissed you one last time, then laid you gently in your crib. I wrapped you in your little blue blanket, took one last look into your blue eyes, then kissed my finger and touched it to your forehead. 'Goodbye, Richard Michael. I love you,' were my last words to you, at least for half a century or so." Anne went on to tell me that after she and Richard were married and the rest of their children came along, she became more and more taken up with finding out what had become of me. In addition to being a naval aviator and an airline pilot, Richard was an attorney, and Anne figured that gave him license to uncover my adoptive identity. But Richard was too much of a gentleman to go back on the adoption agreement made in 1954, and he kept out of the matter. In the early 1970s, with the war in Vietnam still raging, Anne couldn't get the date of my birth out of her head. I would turn 19 in December 1972. Would I go over? If so, what would become of me there? Early on, my plan was to enlist in the Marines to fly. My vision was 20 over 100, and the Air Force required 20 over 20 without correction. Word on the street was that the Marines would take even those of us with 20 over 100 vision and teach us to fly. However, they then started winding down the Vietnam War effort, so I never enlisted. I headed off to med school instead, but Anne knew none of this. In the spring of 1973, they watched as surviving POWs from the Hanoi Hilton disembarked from the planes returning from North Vietnam. They were heartbroken when missing pilots they knew, more than half of Richard's Navy class, failed to emerge from the planes, and Anne got it in her head that I might have been killed over there myself. Once in her mind, the image refused to fade, and for years she was convinced that I had died a grisly death in the rice paddies of Vietnam. She certainly would have been surprised to know that at that time I was just a few miles away from her in Chapel Hill. In the summer of 2008, I met up with my biological father, his brother Bob, and his brother-in-law,